BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Davey Scott here, popping into your classic Scottish albums feed with a bonus episode from BBC Radio Scotland. When we sit down with an artist to talk about their albums, we tend to record way more conversation than we can use in our tightly produced podcasts. So we like to give you the chance to hear your favourite artists raw and uncut too. This week's episode lifts the lid on Delamitri's Waking Hours, so here, in all of its unedited glory, is the conversation I had with Ian Harvey and Justin Curry. And one of the things I love about these conversations is when you speak to musicians about something they did, 30 years ago, it's not just the music they're recalling, but it's themselves. They're thinking about who they were, what it was they were trying to do, and how they got there and where they got with it. It's a lovely conversation. I hope you enjoy it.
Like to binge? Try box sets on BBC Sounds.
The big story about this, in a way, is the change that occurred from the Chrysalis record to this, and I'm sure you're bored to answering it, but I think it's a good question in the context of this record. So what were the key kind of differences between that record and this, and how did you get there?
I listened to the record as an album, listened to Waking Hours as an album for the first time in quite a long time, last week before we were setting this up, and it actually occurred to me how similar it was in some respects to the first album. You know, because that is a big thing about how different it is. And it is different in the sense that we went for more traditional structures. But in terms of the lyrics and what it's about, actually, I think it's very similar. It still felt surprisingly youthful to me when I listened to it.
It's very youthful.
Aye. You know, and at the time we thought we were making a big sort of man's record, but it still is quite... you can hear the boys. You can hear the boys at work in there. So, I mean, I'm sort of sidestepping the question, but actually I don't think it's as dissimilar as people make out.
But I guess it is much more sort of commercially accessible than the first album.
Yeah, I mean, we're kind of self-consciously doing that. I mean, we knew we wanted to be guys who made records for a living, and you've got to sort of come up with... I mean, you've got to get your head around how you're going to do that at some point.
And that is because it has got a big stamp of, you know... the professionalism or strength about the sound of it, Waking Hours, and one of the things that always occurs to me is the sound of the way that the band plays. Oh, and we're going to talk about the songs in more detail, but I think going back to this record myself, I thought, God, the band is, it's really locked, and it's really, there's a precision about it for me, the kind of sound of it. So how much of that was that a long rehearsal process? How much of that was in the studio?
It was a very long process altogether. It was a very long rehearsal process and then a very long recording process, to the extent that we basically recorded it three times. We recorded the whole thing three times. So we eventually demoed all the songs before and after signing to A&M. And we demoed all the songs to quite a high quality. And then we went into the studio with an American producer called David Kirschenbaum, who used to work at A&M as a kind of consultant in LA. And that proved to be an error, a very expensive error. So the band were happening. We'd hired our friend Nick Clark to play bass, so I was just doodling about an acoustic guitar and singing. So we could all play, but the producer and the engineer just... don't know, it was a very odd experience. And so we ended up in LA with a sort of the first master's finished, and Chris Briggs, the guy that signed his A&M, came over to LA and listened to the mixes and just said, what do you want to do? And we just sort of broke down and went, we want to start again. which he let us do. So then we then went and recorded it effectively a third time. And by that point, we
knew the songs.
Well, we knew the songs. We already had sort of two, three different versions of everything. And then we got Hugh Jones in, who produced the first album.
Yeah.
And he didn't want, because drummers were under such pressure in those days to basically sound like drum machines. So he didn't want Paul Tiago, our drummer, to get red light syndrome, or he just didn't want to mess about editing drums and things. I mean, Paul was a very good drummer, but the it was, you know, sounding like a drum machine was a kind of religion in those days. You just wouldn't get played in the radio if your drummer sounded like a real drummer, almost, to a certain extent. That's a bit of an exaggeration. So then Hugh Jones had our drummer play all the top kits, so play the hats and the cymbals and the toms and loads of percussion to what was a kind of early version of programmed kick drum and snare drum. And we also hired a bass player for quite a lot of that stuff because everybody was obsessed with tightness and sounding like, you know, just sounding like some room full of early session musicians that cost $5,000 a day. It was a very odd time. So we did that at the same time as trying to hold on to some kind of band rock thing.
But do you not think that it does have that?
It does, but what occurred to me when I listened to it is side two is very kind of organic. In fact, there's sort of one song in side two, which is quite locked. The side one's very kind of self-conscious about being sort of tidy. I mean, it's really good, but it's side two just sounds a bit more loose or something.
I thought it was kind of, when I listened to it, there was a kind of, almost like a kind of curve in the record, because like Hatful of Rain, it finished with Hatful of Rain and Nothing Ever Happens. And it suddenly goes from this kind of tight 80s sort of thing, it suddenly loosens up on those last two tracks, which is a kind of quite a kind of good wee curve to the story, which I'd never really thought about before. Suddenly this like Hatful of Rain, which has got this big open live drum track, which we'd struggled to achieve on the earlier tracks. I think it's a really brilliant way to close the record. It makes you want to go back and start. I mean, we deliberately put Nothing Ever Happens at the end of it as a sort of lead back into to the beginning of side one. Mm-hmm. And it occurred to me actually Hatful of Rain before that was, it suddenly changes into something a bit more solid in that way that you're talking about. It sort of actually achieves what it was trying to achieve almost in those last two tracks, which was quite interesting. You know?
It's a lovely kind of moment, that the end of it. Another thing I wanted to talk about, the sound, and we've all got into songs, I think it's clearly a song record, but the thing that occurred to me listening back to it was that interplay, Ian, between you and Mick Sladen.
Yes.
Knowing Mick playing as well as I do, I can hear him and I can also hear you, and I can hear the distinctive texture of that.
Yeah.
And maybe talk a wee bit about the process of that and how you arrived at that sound and how you reflect on it.
So, I mean, we kind of flipped around from the original band. I mean, the original band, I was sort of the guitar player and Brian... I mean, we were kind of, it was two guitar players, but I suppose I was always the kind of, I don't know, the sort of leading light, if you want. And suddenly Mick, we were working with Mick, and I could sort of actually step back a bit. And I mean, I learned so much from working with Michael on that record. So yeah, it was a real learning process for me. A kind of a learning process for him, because I think he'd made a couple of albums before where I think he hadn't really kind of been able to focus, or he hadn't been made to focus on what he was doing. And actually get him to focus with somebody else, I thought, you know, there was a really brilliant tension there.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, interesting, when we started touring the record, I kind of had to then sort of pick up Mick's role again, because Mick wouldn't go on tour with us, unfortunately, which is a bit of a sad story, but for all the right reasons. I mean, there was no acrimony there. So I kind of learned from Mick in the studio, and he kind of learned how to sort of work in that sort of way. And then I had to sort of go and sort of be Mick on stage, and we got Dave Cummins in, who then kind of essentially I had to teach David my parts and then learn Michael's, which is quite good fun. What a fantastic learning process.
It's a beautiful, I think the thing is, what I'm really getting at is the sort of beautiful mix of that, of those textures, that really works.
It's fantastic. It's totally fantastic.
One of the places I guess you hear it, and this is where you tell me, no, Mick's the one, that song. I know he co-wrote it as the first single, Kiss This Thing Goodbye.
Mm-hmm.
And that in itself is such a beautiful kind of mixture of different sounds and ideas.
It's all going on.
It's
all going on in that song.
Isn't it just?
It's like this banjos, dobros and mandolin and a bit of acoustic guitar and piano and lead electric guitar. I don't know how it works, but somehow it hangs together.
See, when I heard that on the radio when it first came out, I thought, well, that's a massive hit record.
Well, yeah, it's weird because it got all over radio here and in the US, and it just wasn't a hit.
So tell us about that. So what was that? That must have been quite an impact on you guys, because yeah, it's on a plate, isn't it? And then it doesn't quite happen.
Well, it was the first thing where you turned on the radio at night, like commercial radio stations, and we were on the radio. So that was quite exciting, and Radio 1 played it a bit. I think commercial radio picked up on it first. And then I suppose, I don't know, I don't remember thinking, oh my God, this is going to be a big hit. I think we were just so over the moon for it to be on the radio. And it was, it wasn't designed to be on the radio, but we knew we could hear it on the radio when we'd finished it because it's, you know, just because of the way it sounds. But yeah, it didn't really translate at all. So it never quite edged into the top 40 for some reason.
But it has hung about, hasn't it? And that would be one that's not, you're not going to not play that in a show, right?
I mean, it'll still get played in parts of the US, I think.
I mean, it's an interesting sounding record because it still sounds unusual and powerful. And really, a lot of records that are made around that time sort of just fail to translate. You know, they just sound a bit thin and overproduced.
So talk us through those layers then, because I think that is a fascinating thing about that record towards the end where you're keen, it's all kind of like going. So what are the actual layers you started?
It just came from the funny wee slide riff thing that Justin latched onto. And then the song kind of grew organically out of that.
Originally, it was an anti-Thatcher lyric. And then I realised, this is a really good song. And I've written this rubbish anti-Thatcher protest lyric. So I thought, that's not good. So then we changed the lyrics. Were there lots of different arrangements or not really? I can't really remember.
I really can't remember. Yeah. I mean, it was quite skeletal, I think.
Yeah.
It's quite hard to get it together to play it live because it is kind of an odd sort of skeletal arrangement in terms of the instrumentation.
Things come in and out all the time.
You know, and it's got that guitar of Michael's that you were, you know, talking about, that fantastic sort of really restrained but unbelievably sort of lyrical thing with that amazing guitar tone that you got. You know, and that's a really strange juxtaposition in some respects with, like, sort of banjo, which I think Mick played as well, and in these kind of acoustic instruments and really straight sort of rock drums that were kind of semi-programmed. Like, we spent weeks trying to make sure they didn't sound programmed. It was a heavily produced thing.
It was worked on
a lot, you know, and there was an awful lot of time spent trying to figure out how it was going to go together sonically.
Those were the days when bands had budgets.
That's it.
You know, I mean, you hear these sort of ridiculous stories about, you know, band No CK spending 2 weeks in the studio programming a bloody cowbell or something, you know, and that sort of stuff did go on, you know, and we were kind of on the cusp, we were kind of in that world slightly. It didn't seem mad to spend 3 days, you know, programming a hi-hat. You know,
We got into all sorts of shenanigans.
Well, actually, the hi-hat was played, but a snare, you know, we spent, God,
there was a week at one point on the second song on Opposite View where, because it was the really early days of program. What was the program they used? Was it not Sibelius or something?
No, that's what it was. Early version of Q.
So we had a programmer who was great called Will Mout, I think, and the producer Mark Fregard, and Paul the drummer, and the programmer sat for, it was at least 2 weeks before we had drum tracks for three songs, and at one point, because this program allowed you to put three different snare drum beats in. This is for Blue Nile fans only. Three snare drum beats in, and then the program would randomise them so it sounded real. And then they started trying to do second guess feel. So they started moving snare drums like a hair early and a hair late, and that just didn't work. It was ludicrous. And then they moved them all back right onto the what would you call it? Onto the click.
Right onto the beat.
So it was really worked on.
So and the song itself as well is also really crafted, I think. And I say that with total respect. I love that you hear the craft in it. Was it, you know, you say that you started writing an anti-Thatcher lyric, and then, okay, let's do something else.
Yeah.
Were you aware that you had a single on your hands and you wrote it with that?
I think I changed the lyric because the lyric wasn't good enough for the music. So I think, I very rarely do that. Usually the lyric in Tough Cheese, you know. Tough Cheese. God, I sound like a children's TV presenter. I must have been aware that this was too good a song to waste a crappy 80s, you know, rubbish protest lyric.
So one of the things we started to talk about was the array of really interesting instrumentation on Kiss This Thing Goodbye. And, of course, right at the start, you get that blast of harmonica.
Because we got a guy called Julian Dawson in to play it. But why did we decide harmonica as well? I can't remember why we decided that. Or was it, whose idea was that?
who was working on it. So it was you. It was really just you, me, and Mark Freegard that were working on that track.
Somebody must have said.
Did you try to play harmonica on it?
And then I didn't own a harmonica in those days.
Okay. I certainly wasn't. Somebody must have, I don't know. I mean, we were in the studio for months, years. Yeah. And we hired Tubular Bells at one point. There's Tubular, which actually ended up in the end of Stone Cold Sober. The Tubular Bells came from Maurice Plackett. On somebody had unearthed, this is pre-internet as well, had come up with some dubious fact that there hadn't been a single released with Tubular Bells on and there hadn't been a hit.
That was my idea.
Since Tubular Bells.
That was my idea.
So we hired blooming Tubular Bells. So
the
harmonica
was
quite a straightforward thing to come up with.
Yeah, so Julian Dawson, who was kind of who was the go-to session guy at the time, came in with like a million harmonicas.
As these guys do,
yeah. And he had a brilliant thing called a bass harmonica.
Oh, which is on it as well.
It's
yeah,
on
the
choruses. It kind of goes.
Sounds
like a baritone sax or something.
Yeah. That's all over Pet Sounds, of course. That beautiful.
Yeah. I bought one of those years later, thinking, "Ha ha! Have you ever tried to play one?"
I used to own a chromatic harmonica. I owned it for about 4 weeks, and I gave it to Stevie Jackson.
I bought one of those on tour, so I convinced myself I'd learn how to play it, and within about a week, I was just like, "You've got to be joking."
Yeah, I mean it's complicated, but it does put a big stamp on that sound, doesn't it?
We were looking for those kind of stamps. We were looking for organic sounds, acoustic sounds. You know, we didn't want to put big synth riffs or even necessarily big guitar riffs.
Yeah.
You know, we were looking for those kinds of things. Despite the fact it was a sort of guitar band, we didn't want it to be kind of hair rock in any sort of way or sort of. You know, big sounding guitars. The guitars are all quite restrained, in terms of how they sound and in terms of what they're playing. You know, it's sort of lyrical and it's thought about. You know, mm-hmm. So we were kind of trying to steer away from big guitar riffs. So I mean, I'm with the harmonica. Well, I don't know, Tuesday morning, somebody must have come in the studio going, hire a harmonica player. I mean, those were the days. It was like
you played that song on Letterman as well, so who mind?
Well, no, but
you're
Letterman, you play with a house band, so that was on those days.
So
you
tell us about
band.
That, yeah.
So it was just you and me and Artie Fufkin, or whoever. Yeah. No, he's not called Artie Fufkin, he's Artie Fufkin. And
Paul Schaefer, is about Paul
Schaefer.
Paul Schaefer, sorry, yes, who plays Artie
Fufkin. Who's lovely. He's great to work with.
And was Steve Thomas the drummer at the time? It wasn't Steve Thomas at that point. But yeah, I mean, these guys, you know, and they just had their own arrangement and we just had to kind of do what they said. You do one rehearsal in the afternoon and they're like, oh, there you go.
I don't know what time signature it is, but it's that kind of swing rhythm, like Waterfront by Simple Minds or something. And the bass player at the time was this kind of New York session musician with a big yellow bass, as I remember. In fact,
a yellow bass.
Horrible yellow bass.
Yellow basses?
Somebody does. So anyway, so what they do is they run through their rough arrangement, which is usually really fairly usable. You know, it's like, yeah, we can sing and play along to that. But the bass player decided to slap the bass, and he kept saying to Paul, you know, he says, I'm slapping this, is that okay? And Paul Schaefer was like, yeah, that's fine. I was thinking, no, not slap bass, not slap bass. And then they take you into the gallery and they play you the run through to make sure me and Ian were all right with a thing. And I was like, I'm just, because I didn't feel like we had the status to go, slap the bass, you know. Maybe it's a shame that they didn't keep slapping the bass because it would have been really funny. But then eventually the bass player listened back and went, no, that slap's not right. Oh, no, I'm just going to play it regularly. And I was like, oh, thank God.
Well, I think, you know, being in New York session, I was just a bit bored, started going dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum through the whole track.
Yeah,
it's kind of what it calls for.
They want something to do. But it's amazing, that must have been an incredible experience. And you've done, I think you said you've done Letterman a couple of times.
Aye.
But that kind of exposure. And he really loved it, didn't he?
Letterman liked the album, I think, yeah. I mean, it's hard to know in the States because there's so much... Piola goes on. I'm not saying, but it's hard to know. You know, like we spent so long over there that you just take people at face value, but you don't necessarily trust in their sincerity if that's not a contradiction.
And those things, you know, because you do those things while you're on tour. I mean, you're kind of obsessed with the gigs, and you go, "That's really good news. We're on a late night talk show, and it's quite prestigious and all that sort of stuff." But you're not kind of overawed with it. I mean. We weren't even overawed with Top of the Pops. We were just really pleased to be on there, you know. That stuff never... didn't never find any of that stuff terribly impressive. We knew it was good news for you know, selling more tickets and selling more records, which is great, and more people hearing what we do. We weren't particularly reverent about, oh, wow, man, we're on Letterman. That's a big achievement, because it wasn't really an achievement. It was just the fact the record company worked really hard to get us on there and we were on the radio, so it was a kind of natural thing to happen.
Well, having said that, I do remember being in that, the Rockefeller building, and it is quite an experience.
Yeah,
and then you shoot
it,
because it's sort of live to audience, but it's not live to air. So you can go and watch it afterwards. It's like they shoot it.
Oh, that's right.
They shoot it like 8 in the afternoon or something. They shoot it at 8 in the evening or something. They just shot a couple of hours before and shot as live and then broadcast. So they can redo stuff if they need to. But they didn't really do that. They did it as live. So you just bail out and go and get yourself a drink somewhere and sit and watch yourself.
That was just, fun.
You're
I forgot
like, oh,
about
me
that.
Up there.
That's a beautiful. That's a great moment, isn't it?
Can you turn it up? Sure, is that you guys? Yeah, we'll turn it up.
Let's move on, talk about some of the lyrical kind of themes that are on the record. And there is a kind of thing that comes up now and then all the way through it, this sort of talking about people and places and a bit of dissolution in there as well, I think, and disaffection maybe in people in the middle of these kind of tough times. Mm-hmm. Maybe not quite so firmly and kiss this thing goodbye, but think about something like Move Away Jimmy Blue.
Yeah.
So maybe talk us through that song, which I think it really stands up as a beautiful song. And you kind of believe the people at the heart of it.
Well, Move Away Jimmy Blue, quite similarly to Kiss and Goodbye, came from a kind of Americana type bottleneck thing that Ian had come up with, and then became prior to writing a lot of these songs, we got quite into sort of new country, things like Little Love and Steve Earle, and old country as well. So we'd all of a sudden, we thought, well, it's okay to have a story in a song. You know, it doesn't matter if it's a bit cheesy. So, yeah, Move Away Jimmy Blue is one of those things where I thought, because Ian's riff sounded pretty American, because just a bottleneck naturally sounded American to me, I thought, oh, a kind of country type lyric with a wee story about a kind of disaffected youth or a kind of pariah type person in a wee village somewhere.
And that beautiful, I'm just reading it here, that opening lyric, struck match, faded like a nervous laugh beyond the halo of a faded bulb.
God.
It's beautiful, though. And it does, but it's one of the things, you know, there's a lot of good first lines on this record, I think. And,
yeah.
You know, that sense that you're saying. So how many of, many of these songs, and specifically Move Away Jimmy Blue, how much of that is you guys in the songs, or how much is it the people that you knew, or was it more of a novelist kind of approach?
No, I mean, that Move Away Jimmy Blue was just based on a family that I knew when I was living in a wee village in Leicester, where it was so small that there was only one bad family that were presumed to be bad, and the police were always going round to their door. So anything bad that happened in the village, they get the blame. It was like kind of medieval, you know, pariah, basically. And so it was really just based on that, as far as I remember, with a few things thrown in, perhaps.
Yeah, and that one's a co-write. So is the co-write of that is that a kind of arrangement co-write, or was there a melodic sort of?
Well, it was a riff. It was a riff and two chords. Oh. And that's all it is, isn't it? It's middle eight, but the middle eight, it's just two chords. And it was quite Stonesy and jammy. Remember when we first did it, we were really trying to get a kind of Stonesy groove on it. And then Gil Norton kind of made it more, what did he do with it? He made it more pop or something.
Yeah, I mean, he sort of pulled it together. And I mean, that's one of the few tracks that Paul Tiago actually plays on.
Yeah,
That was an original demo that we just ended up using.
That was the demo that our publisher paid for Gil Norton to produce, to try and get us a record deal, so that kind of led to us getting a deal.
Presumably, I can't even remember the deal, but there must be another two versions of Jimmy Blue lying around somewhere in the archive somewhere, which just didn't come up to the mark.
Yeah.
It goes back to what a convoluted process or lengthy process it was getting the record done. You know, and even after that process, there was that, we went back to that and went, no, the version that we did in, when did we do that? 1986 or something?
87, must
87,
have been.
87, you know, like without the budget in Park Lane Studios, you know, that was the one that we ended up using. And there was a kind of confidence that, you know, after the Kershon, after we'd gone to Los Angeles and realised it was all a bit of a shambles, the recording that we'd done. And we went back and listened to the demos, and we realised the demos were really good. I think that was actually a real sort of confidence booster in a very convoluted kind of way. We thought, we don't need these producers. We don't need to be, I mean, we needed the support of the record company. But in the end, a lot of it was just done in partly in studios on the south side.
Mm-hmm. I think there's quite a few stories like that in Scottish music mm-hmm. from that period. Mm-hmm. I think Park Lane had a certain magic, didn't it, in those days?
It was a good sounding room, and Kenny knew what he was doing, and
he kind of knew when to speak, when not to speak. There was a sort of magic that was happening with a lot of kind of records that got made. I think that's a common story.
Yeah, it will be.
It leads me to another thing about this, and you started talking about elements of this. There was a kind of certain cut of Scottish, maybe specifically Glasgow bands around the kind of late 80s, 90s, that had that kind of Stonesy, almost kind of bluesy thing about them, mm-hmm. you know, and a lot of the park, what we used to think of as the Park Lane kind of bands, mm-hmm. had that sort of thing about them. And it's kind of there to a certain extent in Delamitri as well, mm-hmm. but there's this big glorious slab of melodicism on top of it. Is that a distinction that you're aware of? Is it something that you consciously built?
No, but we certainly... After we went to America and slept on people's floors in 1986, we definitely changed our minds about what kind of influences we would allow to seep into our music. Because prior to that, we were a bit sort of conservative and religious about what we should sound like. So on the first Delamitri album, we were trying to do a very specifically kind of post-Gardy, clean, almost like, it's like an English folk rock record, although I'm not sure that's what we're aiming for. But I think we did get Americanized in some way after coming back from America. So, when Ian was coming up with these slightly kind of bluesy things, we didn't think, we can't do that. Mm-hmm. Of course we can do that. Why not? You know, we can make that work. I guess. I don't know.
We were making the first album, the Chrysalis album, with Hugh Jones again, actually. Yes, I mean, we would self-consciously avoid things that we thought were derivative or in that kind of blues sort of world. And actually, Hugh Jones would quite happily express a distaste for anything that he thinks has come from the blues. So, I mean, there was a kind of, there was an idea that there was a sort of musical political framework that you had to operate within. Uh-huh. And we just kind of junked that. That's a really silly idea. You know, because we were writing stuff that was good and we thought, why don't we just go with this?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, Stone Cold Sober being an example of it, right? And obviously ended up as another single. And I think it was the second single.
And yes, maybe the fourth single, and maybe the sixth single. I don't know.
But that's a really muscular sounding thing.
Yeah.
But it's also got that. Maybe that's where you link that side of Delamitri with those kind of more little bits of portraiture that you do in other songs.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's Stone Cold, so I mean, this tells you how vital it is to have some kind of financial support when you're learning. So we rehearsed a lot with a limited amount of songs. We didn't write screeches and screeches songs, and that song started out as a sort of three chord country song, and then it morphed into this kind of weird U2. I mean, I don't know what it is. It's quite an odd thing altogether, Stone Cold Sober, but it went through a few iterations. But also, the brilliant thing those days is Ian would write songs I would then write lyrics for, but I would write songs variant kind of in that country folky sort of style. But as soon as they went through the Mixlane and Ian Harvey process in rehearsal, they just became something else totally different, which is really exciting if you've just written this thing in your bedroom and you think, oh, that's a good song, but then it becomes a different beast altogether. And again, that's because not only because we had the best two guitar players in the UK probably at the time, but also we were being supported. You know, we were rehearsing 5-6 days a week.
And yeah, so you've got time for these things to light up.
Yeah, and just, you know, we went through, I've got boxes full of rehearsal tapes of countless different versions of everything. And there were only a few absolute dogs that we couldn't make work. This Side of the Morning on Waking Hours being one of them, which eventually we only really arranged at the last moment and really the last session in Park Lane.
That's a cracker though, isn't it? This Side of the Morning.
Yeah, I mean, we always loved the song, but we just couldn't get it working in that kind of rock format, which is what the band suited best, you know. I mean, we couldn't get Nothing Ever Happened to One in that rock format. It didn't really matter. It was just like, it was what it was. But This Side of the Morning was annoying.
That's obviously, there's another story around about that. But in terms of This Side of the Morning, that's, again, another one where again, and you're always in danger, or I'm always in danger of reading too much into things, right? And you can interpret yourself out of reality. I know that. But I do listen to that song, and I wonder if I'm hearing the same people, the same characters cropping up, maybe in Hatful of Rain and that, and others. Is that something you're aware of?
They are all, I mean, most of those characters, apart from, I suppose Jimmy Blue is based on real characters. They're based on something real, but they're not the same characters. But it's definitely, I mean, they were all written in the space of a year and a half or 2 years or something, when, you know, we were in our early 20s and things are happening. You know, you're learning about things and people are falling in and out of love and falling in and out of employment. And, you know, so I suppose it was the same. It was all written basically all written about people at that age, if that makes any sense.
I mean, I think that was one of the other things that occurred to me when I listened to it fresh again last week. I mean, it does feel like a really, almost feels like a collection of short stories. Mm-hmm. It's really, they've got a real kind of homogeneity about the mm-hmm. subject matter, despite the fact the songs are all about different things, apart from Nothing Ever Happens, it then steps into that kind of much more political thing. Mm-hmm. There is a kind of thread that runs through it, I know. Which I never really thought about before. You know, you play these songs on stage for years and years and years and years, and you kind of stop hearing them or you hear them in a different kind of way.
You're also cherry picking them, aren't you, for a set list? But then you listen to that whole thing, and it is like a story album.
I'd never really thought of it as a story album before.
I suppose it's the same cohort. You know, it's the same people that we were seeing in nightclubs and bars that we were either working in or frequenting, and that same group of people that came out of the 80s or were coming out of the 80s and the kind of ruination of Thatcherism in Scotland particularly. And we all went a bit kind of, you know, style. You know, it's like the Glasgow Garden Festival, and this is before, the City of Culture. But it seemed to me a lot of people's reaction to the dismantling of the industrial working class was, let's be urban sophisticates, you know. And it's hard not to cast a fairly sceptical eye over that, and also know that you're one of those people yourself. You're one of those twerps, you know, that I think going to nightclubs is amazing, man.
You started talking about Nothing Ever Happens, and it's quite a good way to pivot, not just from some of the different writing approaches, but also that is the song that lit the record up in terms of its success. Mm-hmm. And it's also clearly lasted the pace in terms of its power and its impact. Again, you've got this novelist thing, you know, post office clerks put up signs saying position closed. I've never heard the word clerks used in a song before, right? And I think it does kind of, you know, it just immediately engages you.
Right.
Are you aware of that tendency in yourself as a lyricist, Justin, to try and open a scene?
Well, I mean, we're talking about this the other day. I mean, partly because we came through the things that switched us on as a young band. I mean, apart from Postcard, although Postcard is relevant to this, because if you look at maybe Joseph K, but certainly Edwin Collins and James Kirk's lyrics, they're extremely odd and unusual. And that kind of fed into Morrissey, whereby the vocabulary that you could use within a pop or a rock song was vastly expanded. You didn't have to stick to baby cars and trains and all that sort of stuff. Obviously there's a broader palette, is that the right word, than that in rock music. But up to that point, there were limitations to what you were sort of allowed to do. So that kind of, things like Edwin Collins and James Kirkman and to a certain extent Morrissey encouraged us to, without being too poncy and literary, just to expand what you could do in a melodic tune that might get played on the radio. But it's a tricky thing to do that, because it can be you know, a lot of those things are a bit verbose, and they probably would be better songs if they weren't so verbose. So there's a bit of a tension between trying to do something a bit clever that you want to do, and also trying to appeal, get people to sing along. So that's quite tricky, I think.
And it also doesn't it make people think, that song, because you know you are sort of like thrown down a gauntlet in a way. You know, like nothing changes. There's an apathy about the way that people react to the world. So people are asked a question in the song.
Maybe, but I don't really listen to lyrics. If I'm listening to the radio, I tend to listen to the tune or what the band are doing, or what the singer sounds like. But I think there is a section of any audience who do listen to lyrics, and that's kind of who you're catering to. But I always say that Nothing Ever Happens kind of broke through. I mean, there were lots of other technical and sort of business reasons why it broke through, partly to do with the time of release and partly to do with the fact that pop radio at the time was a bit stuck in a groove, and it was kind of looking for weird things like this that were melodic. But I think the main reason it broadened our appeal was because you could sing along with the chorus effectively, and it's kind of got a tune. It's got quite an easy tune, which our early songs didn't really have, you know. So I think that's more important than the lyrics. So, but it's nice as a lyricist to sneak in things that you're proud of and get the audience sort of singing along.
But I mean, I think you're underselling it yourself there, Justin. I mean, having that as a chorus that people will sing along to is quite remarkable.
But no, I remember when I wrote that song, I thought that's a cracker. And then I remember playing it to Barbara Shore as our manager at the time, and she said, that's got to be on the album. And I was like, how can you put that on this album? Because we're at the moment, you know, now we're this really brilliant rock band. You know, we've found a sort of niche. But we demoed it, and it kind of worked in the demos. And in the end, we were happy to put it on the record.
And it was a hit. So you've got all of these things, as you say, and it's interesting you're saying there were lots of reasons for it, but it did connect, and it's still. What do you think is the lasting appeal of that song? Is it just the tune, or is it?
Oh, God,
I know that's a tough one, but.
It's got kind of busy. It's a bit like a List song, and List songs are quite popular. And
no,
I can name
it's
some.
It's much better than a List song.
No, it is better than a List song, but it's sort of got that thing, and it's a wee bit cinematic, so there's lots of, I don't often use lyrics that immediately give you a visual image. I'm not particularly good at that. I don't use the gravity towards it, but that song's full of things that put you in that place. They put you in a car park, or they put you in a shop. So I think that really helped it as well. I mean, again, as I said, when I wrote it, I knew it was great. But for me, it was really hard to kind of equate that with what we were trying to do at the time. And we moved a bit more in that direction on the next album. But at the time, I was really into just the way we were sounding as a band. And it's not really a band song. I mean, we sort of had to turn it into a band song, but it's kind of a folk song, isn't it? Is it a folk song?
And I mean, it's not the only thing on the record that's got that influence, is it? And I mean, it's another thing I was going to ask was about the tech, because there's quite a lot of things. I mean, Kiss This Thing Goodbye, but accordions crop up.
We were listening to a lot of Faces and Rod Stewart Rod Stewart stuff at the time. And me, Ian and Mick were all really into those records. I mean, we listened to quite a lot of those records in the studio. We put them on just to sort of refresh our ears.
I mean, the song itself, you were talking about it there, I think the song itself is quite cinematic. I mean, that instrumental section in the middle is quite, it's oddly powerful, in spite of it doesn't really have anything they're going to sing along to. No, but I mean, in a kind of, you know, it's like another scene in the middle of the song. Yeah. And then, you know, you're back to the final, there's a denouement at the end, which is where the lyrics even rack up again.
Absolutely.
You know? So it kind of, I think it's good. It sort of arches in a very interesting way.
Yeah, well, there's a couple, because Kiss This Thing Goodbye is a bit like that as well, because I hadn't written a middle eight.
Kiss This Thing Goodbye is that brilliant thing which I've never heard anyone do, says in that it goes down a tone into the guitar solo.
That's right, and then back up again.
But it means it can go back up into the last chorus, which is an amazing. I remember thinking that at the time, well, that's quite unusual. And again, when I listened to it last week, I was like, bloody hell, that's a remarkable musical device.
These are the advantages of not writing a middle eight, is that you've then got to think, well, we better put something, a new bit in there. And if it's instrumental, why not? I mean, you know, middle eights don't have to have bloody words.
Let's head straight to the sort of success thing then, because what was the experience of that, having been, you know, three versions of an album in, three songs which, certainly two songs which you could have seen were absolutely stick-on hit records, right, mm-hmm. that didn't quite happen, and then mm-hmm. nothing ever happened. So what was the experience of that like for you as people?
I think by the time, so I mean, we went on tour, when did the record come out? In
August. I think we went on tour in August.
We went on tour, we just played, you know,
the university,
rubbish university unions with hardly anybody in them, and, you know, maybe a decent show in London, and mm-hmm. we did a bit of great show, you know, a couple of great shows in Glasgow, great shows in Scotland, but I think by the time what was the second single, Stone Cold Sober, mm-hmm. you know, by the time Nothing Ever Happens coming out, we were kind of thinking, all right, you know, this is the third single, we were about to go on tour again, actually in Scotland, maybe we were at Air Pavilion doing production rehearsals.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
In the first week in January, and I think we were resigned to the fact we'd do another wee tour, we might do another wee few shows, and we'd go make another album. And I remember John, our manager, coming in to the production rehearsals at Air Pavilion, going, "I think we've got a hit." And I was like, "What do you mean?" He went, "Oh, Nothing Ever Happens is selling, I don't know, it was like 2,000 copies a day or something stupid like that at the end." And I was just like, "What?" And that was, and then it just all kind of kicked off.
We were quite
sanguine about the fact that we'd made a really good record, that we'd go and make another really good record.
I mean, we weren't going to be surprised if one of those things was a hit, but we knew there was an enormous amount of luck involved, and because it was all about getting, you know, the A-list at Radio 1, and then it was all about getting Top of the Pops. But I do remember that Air Pavilion gig, because it's quite a big gig, Air Pavilion. What was that, 800 people or something? And we expected there to be a couple of hundred people there, and there were all these kids there because they'd heard us on the radio, and it was a genuine hit. It wasn't being hyped. I'm sure it was being hyped to any extent, as all records were in those days. But it was moving up every week, you know, or every day. More and more people were going out to buy it, and then more people were going to buy it. So I suppose it was quite exciting, you know. But we went, you know, I remember people asking at the time, Are you surprised it was a hit? Well, no, because we know we've made a really good record, and we don't really see any reason why radio shouldn't play these records, and we don't see any reason why we shouldn't be on Top of the Pops, because they're not. This is not math rock, you know. This is it's pretty accessible stuff, and we were pretty sure it was good, so we weren't. Oh my God, what is this? We were just, to a certain extent. I mean, I felt kind of vindicated to a certain extent, because we were sort of regarded as the sort of black sheep of that postcard scene, because we were sort of, you know, they're not cool and all that sort of stuff, which is fine because we weren't particularly cool. So I do remember feeling quite ha-ha. I told you. Which I think is quite a common thing. It's a sad thing to admit.
Yeah, Schadenfreude. So what about, did they then reissue those earlier singles?
Yeah, it still weren't hits. Still never made it in the top 40. But then the album was out by that point.
Well, they might have made the top 40, but they weren't real hits. Yeah. They were just kind of, you know, hyped and bought in and all those shenanigans. Did we do any other Top of the Pops apart from Nothing Ever Happens? Did we do Jimmy Blue until? I can't remember.
On that album?
I can't remember. Might have been too busy.
I mean, apart from the quality of the vocals, which you know, fantastic vocals all the way through your recording career, yeah. But there's a very sort of particular way they're recorded or mixed. They seem quite dry and quite present. And is that something that you've developed as part of your kind of sound, or was it something that came up through the production on that record?
Well, we got really obsessed with dryness on records, because all the records we were listening to from about 86 on were just totally dry, and then we started to get very suspicious of all these AMS reverb soaked and Lexicon reverb soaked records in the 80s. I mean, there's a funny story about that, because we got to tie all this together, all these disparate recordings, we hired Trevor Horn's mixing engineer, a guy called Julian Mendelson, to mix it, who's just got fantastic ears and is brilliantly quick and brilliant at mixing records, did a great Bill and Sebastian record, and a very kind of strange little Australian man, but fantastic at his job. And so he mixed it, and we sent him a couple of tracks to mix as a test, and we went there and they came back really, really wet, loads of reverb and delays and all sorts of things. So we said, yeah, we'd love you to mix the album, but we need to be there to tell you to turn all those things off. And he was like, really? So, I mean, this is a Trevor Horn type mixing approach, you know. So he took all these things off and he was like, that's great. Yeah, it's all right. That's great. But then when we took it, we went to the vinyl cut in Townhouse with a guy called, oh, I can't remember his name, because we were really excited about all the parts of the process. And I mean, I'd been to a 7-inch single cut before, but I'd never been to an album cut before. And we were very precious about how it was going to sound and about levels and all that sort of stuff. So the guy that cut it had started work on it before we got there, and he put reverb on all, the whole album.
At the cut, on
everything. So we said to him, what on earth are you doing? He said, oh, I thought there was something wrong because it said Julian mixed by Julian Mendelssohn, and I've never heard any of his mixes out of this before. Like, stop. And then once he realised that it wasn't a mistake, he was like, oh, this is fine, you know, this is great. So yeah, we were really, really strict about, please, just try and keep things as dry as possible. That being said, there's lots of kind of 80s effects on this record that are kind of subtle, but it does make it sound like an 80s record. You can tell it's not like a record from 92 or 93 or later, when people started making fatter, warmer and drier sounding records.
But beware, he did use a bit of that kind of stuff on the guitars and things.
And the vocal.
I actually didn't particularly like when I heard it this time, but I mean, yeah, the vocal's still dry.
It's but he's got two little
AMS
things either side of it. So
I mean, that was really on you. I mean, it was pretty unheard of to hear vocals that dry at that point. I mean,
and it does add something to the kind of sense of storytelling for me.
No, absolutely.
Yeah. You know, that sense that there's somebody behind you, beside you talking
and
to you.
It helps you balance the vocals a bit so they're not, you know, so they're in with the band, but they've got a bit of clarity. Because if you got a big medley, you know, if you think of Born in the USA or something, one of these 80s records and those kind of sounding records, it makes the voice sound kind of stentorian and declamatory and all that, kind of omnipotent in a way. Whereas when the voice is, it invites you in a bit more, I think, and it makes the singer feel like he's in a room with she's in the room with the band, rather than you're sitting on top of the band and being kind of almighty. So yeah. I think that might have been another. I mean, I don't know if consciously we were concerned about that. We were just trying to copy the sounds we'd heard on Faces records and some Stones records.
It's got a country thing as well.
Yeah.
You know, we were listening to people like Townes Van Zandt and Gary Clark. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, and the vocals on those records are just right there.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a really powerful thing if you can get it to work.
So we're having this as a classic Scottish album, which it definitely is, and I think one of the questions that I always ask guests when we do this is, where do you think it fits in the kind of world of Scottish music? What has Waking Hours? What has the impact of it been in?
Well, I mean, maybe because of kind of inverse snobbery, but we always, I certainly always felt like we didn't really belong in that, in any sort of scene. I mean, there was a real kind of glossy white soul kind of scene that was really big in the mid 80s that we obviously weren't part of. You could never dance to our music at all, so we never fitted into any of that kind of thing. So I've got no idea how it fits beside the other Scottish albums that were released around it. I'm not that aware.
It was a bit of an outlier, I think. You mm-hmm. know, I feel it's like with Wait, 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 and we also sort of putting out albums that were, I mean, I'm Wait, 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 you know, thing. I mean, I kind of, it was in some ways, it's kind of the opposite statement to something like that.
Because
mm-hmm. It is, it's quite introspective
mm-hmm.
In a way that wasn't that cool then, which I think is why it maybe we were perceived as not very cool, and the record was perceived as not very cool, because mm-hmm. it was so introspective
mm-hmm.
and it's sort of about quite sort of quotidian day-to-day things.
Yeah.
I mean, and that was quite a good, I mean, you were deliberately trying to make that statement with the lyrics. I mean, we're sort of trying to make that, we're kind of trying to understate the music as well.
Yeah.
You know, it was sort of about that. It was about sort of being cool without being or making a good sounding record without being bombastic about it.
Yeah, and there was a strain of Scottish rock music that maybe came out of things like Big Country and Simple Minds that was really CinemaScope and or widescreen and really romantic. And I think we didn't really see ourselves part of that at all. We saw ourselves as something much more small and, yeah, quotidian. That's a good word, that, quotidian.
a good word to close. Thank you so much. I think that was fantastic. I just loved going through that with you guys. Great. I love the record. Thank you so much.
And there's only 10 songs on it.
There you go, eh?
Next time, I'll be chatting to Katie Tunstall about Eye to the Telescope, and you'll get to hear her uncut interview in another bonus episode. And if you're enjoying the Classic Scottish Albums feed, please spread the word, and if you can, leave us a review and rate the podcast on your app. Honestly, it helps us convince the bosses here to let us make some more. And on that note, also, tell us who else you'd like to hear. What's your favourite classic Scottish album? You'll find us on BBC Radio Scotland's social media feeds, and we'd love to hear from you. I'm Davey Scott. Thanks for listening.
Enjoyed this podcast? Discover more music, radio and podcasts on BBC Sounds.